It's the Tennessee Star Report with Michael Patrick Leahy.
And welcome back to the Tennessee Star Report. It is 7:06 a.m. It is Friday, October 9th. 25 days, Crom, before the big election. And I wonder, Crom, what's going to happen on election night and what's going to happen in the month after election night?
Well, those are very good questions. Let me kind of continue on our theme here. But a friend of mine sent me an email commenting on during the debate, Kamala Harris brought up Honest Abe and how Honest Abe, when Justice Taney, who Abe Lincoln hated, and for good reason.
For very good reason.
Yeah. Justice Taney either retired or died. I don't remember which, but no, it says he died. Okay, so it says there was 56 days, pretty much in line. There was 56 days between his death and the election. And Harris said that Honest Abe did not appoint somebody to replace Taney. What she didn't acknowledge is that the reason that Honest Abe didn't is that the Senate was not in session. Mm-hmm. And back in those days, by the way, you couldn't call an emergency session and people jump on a jet and fly back into Washington. So when the Senate wasn't in session back in those days, you waited until it came back into session.
Taney died on October 12th, 1864. The Senate was not in session. We were in the middle of a civil war at the time.
Yes.
Atlanta had fallen, and John Bell Hood was marching up towards Franklin.
Yes, okay. But the Senate wasn't in session. Kamala Harris did not mention that. What she also didn't mention is then after the election, but before the inauguration, and the party, by the way, controlling the Senate was going to change after they came back into session after the lame duck session, Abe Lincoln did appoint a justice who then replaced Taney. So Kamala Harris got it exactly backwards. The story that she says, and Chase was then confirmed on the very same day. So that is what happened. Says the very next day, December 6th, the election was December 5th. Excuse me. The Senate wouldn't be back until December 5th, 27 days after the election. The very next day, on December 6th, 1864, a reelected Lincoln submitted his nomination for the Supreme Court Chief Justice to the lame duck Republican Senate. His former Treasury Secretary, Salmon Chase. Chase was confirmed the very same day.
And Chase, by the way, ended up being a very good justice.
Yes, but anyway, so Kamala Harris was either incredibly misinformed, or she is a very accomplished liar.
It's the latter, I think. She's a former attorney general in the state of California. You gotta know this stuff.
You think? Okay. Yeah. All right then. I'll accept that. I'm just trying to give her a little wiggle room that she's either very misinformed, which, by the way, either is terrible. It means that she makes decisions, important decisions, either based on false information and doesn't know the difference to check it, or she knows the information and just makes stuff up. But let's move to the other point that's going on in this election that you brought up. And we've been talking about this a lot. In the state of Georgia, a court in Georgia has put a stay on the lower court's judge who extended the voting past Election Day, the counting of votes that came in past Election Day.
The Democrat fraud machine.
Yes. Even though the law says that the ballots must be in, if they're going to be counted, they must be in. He changed that. The court changed that. Here are the states right now that are in question from this. And it's all because Democrats are ignoring the constitutional provision that says that election laws are set by the legislators of each state. Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Georgia, and Montana. Now, there are other cases, there are other states where you have issues going on, and they're over. Apparently, there are over 300 lawsuits that are going to be filtering their way up.
Speaking of lawsuits, right after this break, Crom, we're going to hear from Jim Roberts, and I think he's got some legal pushback to the usurpations of power by the Davidson County Election Commission by their refusal to follow the law and schedule this Nashville Taxpayer Protection Act referendum. So when we come back, Jim Roberts.
Tennessee Star Report with Michael Patrick Leahy.
And welcome back to the Tennessee Star Report. 7:17 a.m., Friday, October 9th, 2020, 25 days before the general presidential election. We're joined now on our newsmaker line by our good friend, Attorney Jim Roberts. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, sir. How are you doing on this beautiful day?
We're doing great. So, I think you have some news to report about legal actions taken in the Nashville Taxpayer Protection Act referendum issue. Tell us what's happening.
Well, as you probably know, your listeners know, about 2 weeks ago, the Election Commission voted to hire outside counsel and to sue the 27,000 citizens who had prepared and filed a ballot initiative. They've pretty much been sitting on their hands. And so last night, since time was running out, I filed on behalf of For Good Government a complaint in Chancery Court for a mandamus to force the Election Commission to get off their tail ends and put this measure on the ballot as they're legally required to do.
Well, they are legally required to do it. They have a ministerial duty to do that. The Tennessee Supreme Court so ruled in 2004.
Right.
What happens next?
Well, I waited to see if they would actually take action, and I think they just chickened out, to be honest with you. I think they realized the optics of suing the citizens was a bad move, and they decided they would just wait it out. And so their idea was, we'll just do nothing and let the time run out. So we filed a lawsuit. The next step, along with that lawsuit, is a motion for an expedited hearing. And really, sometime this morning, I need to be on the phone talking to the judge's office. I don't know which judge has gotten the case yet. I need to make sure the judge knows about it and get this hearing set. Hopefully we can get it set Monday or Tuesday of next week. There's no reason to delay on this. People's rights are being violated, and get this measure put to bed. I'm back on the ballot. So.
And will it be on the ballot on December 5th as you had, as was stipulated in the ballot? I mean, in the
petition.
But the petition?
That's what we sued for. Further research has given me the belief that I had already, but affirmed the belief that there's no legal basis to move this date, that they don't have a right to do that. Just because they did it doesn't mean it's right, and they need to be forced to do what the people told them. One, and also it sets a bad precedent. Giving the Election Commission more authority than they really have is probably a bad idea, because they don't seem to be able to use it well to begin with.
Yeah, the Metro Charter is crystal clear on this, that the petition prescribes, and that's a legal term, or it means, you know, legally sets the date for the election, and you did so December 5th, and we finally got the Election Commission Administrator to send us the a legal justification, and I'm not the attorney, but you looked at it as well, and it's a smokescreen used to move it to December 15th. That was my take on it. What was yours?
Same. I don't think there's any legal basis for it. There is some law out there that allows the Election Commission to move certain types of elections, and that has to do with recall elections and things like that, but not ballot initiatives. They don't have that authority, and they need to be called out for that.
So at the September 25th meeting of the Davidson County Election Commission, they did two things. They postponed the election to a conditional date of December 15th, which you argue is they didn't have the authority to do. But they also decided to hire a law firm to file for declaratory judgment in Davidson County Chancery Court to basically tell them, oh, we think this is illegal. But they haven't done that yet, have they? They haven't filed that declaratory judgment, have they?
No, they didn't. They took no action. I did get an email from the attorney that they hired, and he seemed to think that this case was, would take months to move through the court system. And I've been involved in election lawsuits, and they take days generally to resolve, maybe even a week at the most, because they're of such importance. I mean, this is not just about me in any way. It's about the fact that 27,000 people signed a petition telling the government to do something, which was really simple. Put this measure on the ballot. Didn't say they had to do it. I mean, the people still get a chance to vote yes or no on it. But this is really clear. I mean, 27,000 citizens said, I want the rest of the city to have a chance to vote on this. And the Election Commission doesn't get to just say, well, we don't think it's a good idea, or we don't think they deserve to vote. They don't have that authority or that discretion.
In essence, they're denying the voting rights to 27,000 residents of Davidson County.
Well, and all the other residents.
Yeah, and the others.
And all the others.
Yeah, very good point.
Further than that, they're denying every single registered voter in this county. They're violating their civil rights. The federal case law is very clear on this. It's unconstitutional from the United States Constitution to do what they're doing, and they simply do not care.
So when you have this hearing with the Monday or Tuesday with whichever judge in Chancery Court picked it up, what's going to happen? Who will be there? What will you say? And what will the Election Commission say?
Well, fortunately, my arguments are going to be pretty simple. I'm going to hand the judge a copy of the charter, and I'm going to point out that we've done everything we're supposed to do, and I'm going to look at the judge and say, now it's time for you to tell the government to get off their tail end and do their job. I'm waiting to see what Metro is going to say about this. They're going to hem and haw, and they're going to have a lot to say about it. But in the end, they are failing to do their job because they just simply don't want to.
Now, did you sue anybody in it, or did you just ask the court to rule and hold a hearing?
Well, technically you can't really sue the Election Commission because it's part of the Metro government. So you sue the Metropolitan government in general, and so they're the defendant in the case. And I think that may have been why they had some trouble deciding what they were going to do. They wanted to file a lawsuit, but they didn't really know who to sue. And the only entity to sue was the 27,000 voters of Davidson County.
So in this hearing, who will represent the Metro government? Will they be at this hearing on Tuesday or so with the judge?
Oh, I'm sure Bob Cooper and the normal team of lawyers will be there. This isn't my first election case, and in fact, I suspect it'll be Laura Fox, who's an attorney for Metro. She was on the case I was on 12 years ago, and over this same issue about putting things on the ballot, I suspect they'll send her back down because she's experienced at it.
What will her argument be?
I think her argument will try to be that we think, meaning Metro Legal, thinks that somehow this is unconstitutional, and so
that the referendum itself is unconstitutional.
That's right. That's what her argument will be, I suspect.
Right. But the Tennessee Supreme Court ruled on that in 2004 and said you got no place to make that argument until after the referendum is held.
You know that, and I know that, but apparently Metro Legal didn't get a copy of that opinion.
Yeah, I think they got a copy of the opinion.
this is disingenuous. I mean, you have to understand that, unfortunately, Metro Legal will take the position of whatever the mayor wants, whether it's accurate or not. And so it's been my experience that they play the tune of the piper or the person who pays them. I mean, it's just that simple.
So after hearing on Tuesday, you make your case. The lawyer for Metro makes their case. What happens? What does the judge do?
Well, the normal thing to do, the judge would issue a mandamus ordering the Election Commission to meet and to vote and to place it on the ballot. I suspect that they will go on there and start claiming that now there's not enough time, that they can't do it on the 5th, you know, that they've basically messed around and now it's my fault, you know, that I didn't sue them sooner. that's the kind of argument. But yeah, that's what they're going to say.
You really? That's what they're going to argue? I mean, they could. It's so ridiculous, but maybe, yeah.
I think they still have time to put it on the December 5th ballot. I think there is some lead-up time to do that. But because this is a single-issue measure, it's not like putting together the November presidential ballot where you have dozens of races and all these different things. This is a one issue.
It's like 56 days from now, so yeah, that's plenty of time, I think.
Jim,
They should be preparing for it. I mean, honestly, if these folks are competent, they're going ahead and doing the things that they need to do to be ready for this ballot. I think they know what's going to be. There's going to be an election, whether it's the 5th or the 15th. There's going to be an election because I think they know they're wrong. But they just don't care.
Jim,
you just have to grasp the fact that Metro does not care because they want this off the ballot. They so want your tax dollars that they will say and do.
Crom's got a last question here. We got
Jim,
1 minute.
Jim, well, it's a comment. Yes, it's a comment to get your comment. So this, in essence, in the pure essence of this, this is the city of Nashville, the government of Nashville, suing its own people, or refusing to follow the law. I mean, the battle is between the government and the people.
Yeah, we got 20 seconds, Jim.
That's right. So that's exactly what the battle is, and the government threatened to sue the people, and then they decided to sit on their hands, so the people just sued them.
Jim Roberts, a great attorney, a great American, a great Nashvillian. Thanks for being with us.
Yes, sir. Y'all have a good day.
All right. Back with the Tennessee Star Report after this.
The Tennessee Star Report with Michael Patrick Leahy.
And welcome back to the Tennessee Star Report. Michael Patrick Leahy with Crom Carmichael here at 7:33 a.m. Crom, listening to the news. Very alarming. Tennessee is in the red zone in coronavirus cases. What really does that mean?
I have no earthly idea what the red zone is.
Red zone? Is it like the football last 20 yards?
Well, they just keep moving. What they do is the authorities just keep moving, and the media kind of plays along. They keep moving the goalposts. If you'll recall, flattening the curve to begin with had all to do about making sure that we had enough medical facilities to support the people who needed them. So then once we got past that, then all of a sudden, then what mattered was cases. Mm-hmm. The number of cases. It didn't matter whether or not the people who came down with coronavirus recovered and never had to go to the hospital. That didn't matter. It just became the number of cases. Then they made it the number of deaths. But included in the number of deaths are people who died primarily from some other illness, but happened to have coronavirus when they died. And we know that to be true.
Mm-hmm.
We know that to be true because the United States represents 5% of the world population, but it represents 25% of the deaths in the world from coronavirus, which means that either the rest of the world is grossly underreporting the number of deaths, or it means that we're grossly overreporting.
I'm guessing it's the latter.
Well, we are, because the other countries in the world, when they report a death from coronavirus, it's actually a death from coronavirus. It's not somebody who was in the process of dying from cancer who also turned out to have coronavirus.
Mm-hmm.
George Floyd, turns out, had coronavirus. When he died, he had coronavirus.
Is he listed among them?
I have no idea, but they did report that he had coronavirus.
Yeah.
And so you have this problem with the language. One thing that Trump should have done at the very outset. Well, there are three things I wish he had done. One is I wish he had required the CDC to report the number of deaths only from coronavirus. If they want to report the other, that's mm-hmm. okay. But they ought to have to report the number of deaths that were exclusively from coronavirus. The other is he should have had the CDC report the number of people who died in the United States from other causes
mm-hmm.
During the same time period, because then you'd see just how many people died from other things. And then the third thing that he should have done was when he put in the national emergency or whatever it is, he said, until these national emergency dictates are lifted, no reporter, no member of the media can make more than the average cameraman.
Mm.
That's what they should have done.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, the people who do the reporting and their bosses, this would have been from the president of NBC News all the way down. They can make no more money during the pandemic than the cameraman, than the average cameraman's salary.
It's only fair, Crump.
And that would be fair. Yeah. And it would also have them focus on the fact that there are competing, what Trey Gowdy called competing harms.
Mm-hmm.
When you have competing harms, you make the best decision you can, recognizing that whatever decision you make, there's going to be some negative effect. And so what you hope to do is you hope to make the decision that has the fewest negative effects. And but getting back to what we were talking about, Michael, with Jim Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
A great attorney. Yes.
We
talk a lot about institutional constraints. And we're very fortunate here in Nashville to have a Nashville charter that allows the voters to ultimately provide that institutional constraint against a government policy that they don't like. And in this case, the vote, 27,000 people said we'd like to have all the voters have an opportunity to chime in on whether or not a 34% tax increase is in the city's interest. And who better to decide that than the people who live here, the voters, not the government that controls. And you know, government elected officials like to call themselves public servants. What a crock.
Good catch.
What a crock.
Good catch, sir.
What a crock that is in this case.
They're not public servants.
No, in fact, all across the country. But this is what we're really, the Constitution was not a perfect document. In fact, the people who signed the Constitution and completed it knew it wasn't a perfect document. But it was the best that they could come up with given the circumstances at the time. Because you had, in order to have the Constitution take effect, you had to have a certain number of states, or maybe it was all of them, I don't remember, Michael, you would know this, certain number of states had to vote, their legislators had to vote yes on the Constitution.
Nine out of 13.
Nine out of 13. And ultimately, all 13 did.
Ultimately. Although Rhode Island took a long time to do it.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's great information. But nine had to.
Yes.
So they had to create a document that would get nine states to agree to it. And so what the purpose of the Constitution was, including its flaws, but what its purpose was to make a national government possible and also then limit the powers of that national government.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it with checks and balances and institutional constraints. They had the executive branch, they had the Congress, and they had the courts. And it was the role of the courts to make sure that the executive branch and the legislative branch did not overstep their authority under the Constitution. And it is institutional constraints. You see it right here in Nashville. The Democrat Party controls the city government.
Absolutely.
It does not want to be constrained by the city, by the charter.
At all. It was no constraints on spending.
And by the way, to Bob Cooper, I'm sure you're a nice guy.
Bob Cooper, the Metro League.
Yeah, I'm sure you're a nice guy.
Former Attorney General.
Yeah, what you're arguing is wrong.
Yeah, it's very wrong.
It's wrong. It is not just a bad legal argument. If you try to blow up the institutional constraints, we're going to end up just the same situation as Chicago, because that's human nature. So it's very, very important that this institutional constraint.
You know, I really would like to have Bob Cooper come in here.
I'd love for these people.
We should have him in. We're not mean people.
No.
We are vigorous proponents of our point of view, and I think Bob Cooper certainly has the intellect and the capability to handle us here one on one in the studio. We'll invite him.
Yeah, the mayor does too.
Well,
no, the mayor does too. You've invited him to come on the show.
He's welcome.
I understand,
times.
But he's welcome anytime.
He is welcome.
Yeah, and the point of the institutional constraint, I don't know how the voters will vote. I think I know. I have a prediction of how they'd vote, but that doesn't mean I'm right.
Yeah.
But the institutional constraint is to allow if the proper steps are taken, which Jim Roberts and his organization did, the proper steps have been taken. The voters now get to chime in on whether or not they think the government has done something that it shouldn't.
You know, I think it would be a great public service, Crom, if we would invite, we could invite both Mayor John Cooper and Metro Legal Director Bob Cooper to come in, sit here with us, and have we'll dedicate the entire hour and a half that you're in here, any Monday, Wednesday, or Friday, and we'll just have an open discussion about this issue. And we'll make our case, they'll make their case, and our listeners, you know, can decide what they think. Now, it's not a judicial hearing, right? That's where how they want to handle it. But, you know, the court of public opinion matters, I think.
Well, it's supposed to. That's the whole point. That's what this is. So in Metro, our institutional constraint has been given to the citizens if they follow a certain
through
procedure.
Through the charter. Yeah.
At the state level, our government is constrained because we have to balance our budget. And we don't have an income tax. And so the government, even when the Democrats ran the state, and they did back in the 80s, the Democrats were in control of the state. The Democrats still had to manage within the constraints that existed. And so it's very, very when institutional constraints are abandoned, mm-hmm. and that's what the Democrat Party is trying to do nationally.
Yes.
When institutional constraints are abandoned, terrible things happen as a result because human nature is a constant.
Absolutely. Speaking of human nature being a constant, we have actually kind of a firsthand commentary, if you will, from Kevin in Michigan. Kevin, come on in and tell us about the Michigan Militia Institute.
I'm retired out of Michigan law enforcement. I live down here, Tom. I've talked to you several times. What happened up in Michigan with this Michigan militia is only the tip of the iceberg. These 13 people, and there's probably more, are the extreme radical. I'm not going to call them left or right. They're extreme radical individuals that are way off the charts. But in Michigan alone, on opening day of deer season, which is November 15th, there's 750,000 men and women in the woods. I was a young boy, and my father said, there's your Michigan militia right there. Well, a lot of those men and women are now gone. They're dead or old, like me, and older. But if you think that militia up there is nothing to worry about or nothing to think about, you better reevaluate yourself.
Kevin.
Because up there in Michigan, they are powerful, they are strong, and I dealt with them a lot as a law enforcement officer.
And they're a little bit difficult to read. Kevin, thanks for that. Back after this with the Tennessee Star Report.
The Tennessee Star Report with Michael Patrick Leahy.
And welcome back to the Tennessee Star Report. 7:49 a.m. broadcasting live from our studios on Music Row. Crom, you know, we've been talking about the efforts of the deep state, the mainstream media, the elements of the national intelligence community to undermine the Trump presidency. Been going on for some time, Crom. How long has that been?
Well, Michael, this gets into this area, this general area that we're talking about institutional constraints. We have an FBI, we have a Justice Department that is supposed to be nonpartisan. We have a CIA that is supposed to work in the interests of the United States and to respect our democratic processes and our elections. But what we've learned is that during the Obama-Biden administration, they selected people and put in these various areas of the Department of Justice, the FBI, and the CIA who are corrupt. They were intellectual prostitutes. They were dishonest people and they did the bidding of the Obama-Biden administration. But when Trump won, this is from Ron Johnson, Senator Ron Johnson, who wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal. So some of this I'm going to be quoting. Some of them just going to be pontificating, so to speak. But he points out that during the first 125 days of Trump's presidency, now that is essentially 4 months, there were 62 leaks that could possibly endanger national security. 62 leaks. In 4 months. Under George Bush, there were 9 leaks in 8 years. Mm-hmm. Under Barack Obama, there were 8 leaks in 8 years. So in under Bush and under Obama, the leaks were about one a year. Under Trump, there were 15 a month, more than 15 a month during his first 125 days. And those are the people who were there left by Obama and Biden, corrupt to the core. I mean, this is...
To the core.
To the core. And the actors at the FBI, he points out, I'm going to quote here, their actions can only be described as an attempted coup. As the Ukrainian whistleblower's attorney, Mark Zayed, did in a January 30th, 2017 tweet, hashtag, coup has started, first of many steps, hashtag rebellion, hashtag impeachment will follow ultimately. And how did the media respond to the attempted coup? They piled on and said, this is great.
Yeah.
Now, the question that I have is, one of the institutional constraints, Michael, that we should have in this country is a vigilant media that is in the business of standing up for the people against the government. So you have a new government where you have an attempted coup by the former government. And by the way, that attempted coup was going on during the election.
Yeah.
And then during the interim period between the election and the inauguration.
Mike Flynn setup case.
And then after the election. What was the media's role in uncovering the corruption? It was zero.
The mainstream media.
The mainstream media's
Breitbart reported on it.
Yeah, some media did, and then the tech industry then tried to cover what Breitbart reported.
Yeah,
and so
they're still trying to they're
and that's ongoing.
Yeah, ongoing. I mean, Google is suppressing Breitbart and the Tennessee Star.
Yeah,
and Just the News.
So here's what Ron Johnson said. So here's what we know so far. On July 5th, 2016, then FBI Director James Comey overstepped his authority and publicly exonerated Hillary Clinton while criticizing her conduct. On the same day in London, the FBI met with Christopher Steele, author of the now debunked anti-Trump dossier. The U.S. intelligence agencies received reporting that Russians believed Hillary Clinton approved a plan on July 26, 2016, to stir up a scandal by tying Trump to Russian hacking of the Democrat National Committee email server, which, by the way, that story was then repeated over and over again as so that it would become truth rather than the falsehood that it always was.
Yeah, and that's a part of the technique. Repeat a falsehood over and over and over and over again, as right. in, Mr. President— won't you denounce white supremacy?
Right, exactly, yeah. exactly. Then CIA Director John Brennan later briefed President Obama about this reporting. Also on July 26th, a friendly foreign government, in quotes, gave the charge d'affaires at the U.S. Embassy in London information that George Papadopoulos, quote, suggested the Trump team had received some kind of suggestion, unquote, that Russia might release information damaging to Clinton. So all of this, Michael, was contrived. And it was contrived by the very people that Obama and Biden put in charge. So for those folks out there who want honest government, look in the mirror and ask yourself whether or not the Democrat Party represented by Biden and by Obama acted honestly and with any sense of decorum. And if you conclude that they did, then you're either a fool or you just want to just ignore.
You've given up.
You've just given up, yeah. And you're ignoring the fact.
Well, this is our problem, isn't it?
And by the way, even if Trump gets reelected, which yeah. I do expect will happen, but then the second Trump term, I believe a lot of this will be uncovered. But if he's not, it will be covered up forever.
Absolutely. Well, on that cheery note, we're going to close out the week.
And may everybody have a wonderful weekend.
Up next, Glenn Beck, 11 o'clock, Rush Limbaugh, 2 o'clock, Sean Hannity. I'll be back Monday morning at 5 o'clock. This is the Tennessee Star Report. Have a great weekend. I'm Michael Patrick Leahy.